She vanished in 1996 after a college party. No body, no arrest, no answers for 26 years. But behind the silence was a predator. And behind that predator, a secret buried in the backyard of a quiet California town. Told from a raw first-person perspective, this true crime audiobook unravels the case of Kristen Smart, the freshman who never came home, and the community that refused to forget her. Fueled by a podcast, haunted by a trial, and aching for closure, this is the story of justice decades delayed, but never denied. Press play, and don't look away. Welcome to the Murder Tape Chronicles audiobook. If you haven't already, please consider following us on your favorite podcast platform. Today we present to you Justice 26 Years in the Making. Let's dive into this thrilling narrative together. Chapter 1, The Walk Back from Nowhere. You can live your whole life believing that truth always comes out in the end. That justice is patient, that it waits, somewhere just beyond the reach of time, and that when it finally shows up, it'll be wearing a badge and holding the answers you prayed for. But that's a goddamn lie. Justice isn't patient. Justice is a ghost, drifting just out of sight. And sometimes it never shows up at all. I didn't know Kristen Smart personally. I never shook her hand, never sat beside her in a lecture hall. But the first time I saw her photo, something cracked open in me. It was years later, long after she vanished, after the headlines had yellowed, after the missing posters had faded under the California sun. But that picture, that fucking picture stuck. Blonde hair, a quiet smile, like she knew something beautiful was ahead, and she was ready to meet it. It was May 25th, 1996. Memorial Day weekend. Cal Poly was winding down for the year, and students were chasing their last moments of freedom before the summer swallowed them whole. That night, Kristen went to an off-campus party, just like 100 other kids did. Just like I did back in the day. Nothing dramatic. Just one of those house parties with red solo cups, cheap beer, bad lighting, and the pulse of music coming through the walls like a heartbeat. She didn't bring her purse. Didn't have her phone. Back then, most of us didn't. No tracking apps. No Find My iPhone. She wore borrowed clothes, a crop top, black shorts, sneakers. She told her roommate she'd be back later. She never made it back. Somewhere between that party and her dorm, Kristen Smart vanished off the face of the earth. And it was like no one noticed. Not fast enough. The guy who walked her part of the way home, his name was Paul Flores. And yeah, I'm saying his name. I'm not giving him the satisfaction of anonymity. He was the last person to see her alive, and from the beginning, something about his story reeked. He told investigators he walked her as far as his dorm, and that she continued on foot alone from there. A simple, clean exit. Too clean. But let me back up, because this isn't just about the moment she vanished, it's about the world that allowed it to happen. About the systems that failed her. About how silence, when echoed long enough, becomes a weapon more dangerous than any gun. That night, multiple witnesses said Kristen was intoxicated, stumbling, unable to walk on her own. One girl even said Kristen passed out on the lawn during the party and had to be helped up. Paul, he lingered, hovered, volunteered to walk her back. People remember that. The way he inserted himself. The way his eyes lingered on her like she was prey. He said she insisted on walking the rest of the way alone. But that's not how vulnerability works. That's not how safety works. Not at 2:30 in the morning. Not when you're 19, barefoot, and can barely stand. The next morning, Kristen didn't show up to breakfast. Her roommates noticed her bed was untouched, her shoes were still gone, her things undisturbed. She hadn't called. Hadn't checked in. She'd just vanished. And when they went to the campus police, they were told to wait. They were told Kristen was probably just off with friends. Maybe she took a spontaneous trip. Maybe she needed space. I can't count how many times I've heard that fucking line. She probably just needed space. No, Kristen didn't need space. She needed help. And she needed it fast. 3. Fucking. Days. That's how long it took for law enforcement to officially open a missing persons case. By then, whatever had happened to Kristen was buried in time, wiped clean, and soaked into the shadows of a campus that didn't want bad press. But her family, Stan and Denise, they knew something was wrong. They weren't the kind of people to scream, but their grief was deafening. Stan drove 6 hours that same day when he heard his daughter was missing. Denise stayed behind in Stockton, calling hospitals, faxing photos, begging for someone, anyone, to care. They didn't just lose their daughter. They lost faith in the system meant to protect her. Cal Poly did jack shit in those early days. That's not opinion. That's fact. There was no urgency, no push for answers. The search was superficial, symbolic at best. Paul Flores was questioned briefly, his dorm room checked a month later, after he had time to clean it, clear it, and cover his tracks. Police had cadaver dogs sniff through the building. One of the dogs alerted, strongly, to the scent of human decomposition near Flores' bed. That wasn't a maybe. That was a yes. A definitive, trained reaction. But still nothing happened. Paul refused to answer questions. Lawyered up. Stopped cooperating. And somehow that was allowed. You tell me, if you're the last person seen with a missing girl, and your room smells like death, and you won't talk, how are you not hauled in? But there was no arrest. No trial. No justice. And so the years began to stack like bricks on a grave that had no body. 1997, 1998, 1999, time marched forward, but Kristen didn't. Her name faded from headlines. Her face stopped appearing on the news. Other stories took her place. Other tragedies. Other missing girls. But I never stopped thinking about her. And I wasn't the only one. Her parents never gave up. They filed civil suits. They stood on courthouse steps. They wrote letters. They held vigils. They kept her room the same, even when the walls began to yellow. Her siblings grew up without her. Birthdays came and went with an empty chair. Every time they were interviewed, you could see the exhaustion in their eyes, but you could also see fire. That's what hope does when it turns to fury. In 2002, Kristen was declared legally dead. The state acknowledged she would not be coming home. No funeral. No burial. Just a line in a court record stating that she no longer existed. Paul Flores moved on. Changed jobs. Got arrested a few times for alcohol-related incidents. One time, he was pulled over for having a gun in his vehicle. Another time, for assault. But the big charge? The one that mattered? That never came. And for most people, that would have been the end. But not for us. Not for the listeners. Not for the ones who still had questions. Because in 2019, a man named Chris Lambert, just a musician with a microphone, decided to start digging. And what he uncovered changed everything. Your Own Backyard wasn't just a podcast. It was a call to arms. It was journalism without a newsroom. It was what happens when ordinary people refuse to let go. And through it, a voice that had been buried for decades was about to rise. Chapter 2, The Voice in the Static. You don't expect a podcast to change your life. Not really. I mean, sure, there's true crime junkies and armchair detectives scrolling Reddit at 2 a.m., whispering theories into the dark. But for most of us, these cases just pass through our ears and echo for a bit before fading. But Your Own Backyard wasn't that kind of podcast. It didn't whisper. It roared. By the time I stumbled onto the first episode in 2019, I was half listening, half living. Life had numbed me. You know the feeling, where everything's a blur of notifications, half-read headlines, a world that moves too fast for anything to matter. And then I heard her name again. Kristen Smart. It hit like a slap. Like someone reached into the fog of my mind and yanked her back to the front of it. She was still missing. And someone was still talking about her. That someone was Chris Lambert, a local musician who couldn't shake Kristen's story either. He wasn't a detective. He wasn't a reporter. He was just a guy who cared too much. But sometimes, that's exactly the person you need. He started the podcast as a passion project. Small mic, no budget, a hunch, and a hole in his gut that said something was wrong. He lived near Cal Poly. He remembered the flyers. The silence. The way Kristen's name had slowly disappeared from public memory. He couldn't let that happen. And so, in his garage, surrounded by old instruments and borrowed soundproof foam, he started building something more powerful than any news outlet had ever dared to try. Your Own Backyard wasn't about sensationalism. It wasn't about blood and horror for the sake of downloads. It was human, intimate, patient. Every word stitched together with care. Every pause loaded with the weight of a story no one else wanted to carry anymore. I still remember the moment I realized this wasn't just a podcast. It was a resurrection. Chris didn't just report facts. He walked the ground Kristen had walked. He knocked on doors that had been closed for two decades. He found people who hadn't spoken in years. Old friends, classmates, cops, neighbors, former co-workers of Paul Flores. And one by one, they started talking. It was like he'd cracked something open. like he'd reached through time and reminded the world that Kristen wasn't a cold case. She was a person, a daughter, a sister, a girl with dreams who was swallowed whole by something monstrous. And suddenly, people started listening. Not just true crime fans, but real people, mothers, fathers, students. Listeners who had never cared about a missing person case in their life suddenly couldn't sleep without knowing more. The show climbed the charts, from nothing to viral in a matter of months. And with every new episode, the walls started to shake around Paul Flores. Because here's the thing about secrets, they don't like microphones. And Paul, he had plenty of them. Chris found former acquaintances who remembered things, details long buried in shame and uncertainty. One woman remembered Paul bragging about getting away with murder. Another recalled an unsettling moment when he tried to lure her into his truck. A third had heard rumors about the night Kristen disappeared, that something violent happened in his dorm room, and his father may have helped clean it up. You see the pattern? It wasn't just one creepy moment. It was a trail. A trail no one had followed closely enough, until now. And the podcast didn't just stir up memories. It stirred up tips. Dozens. Then hundreds. From listeners, from old friends, from people who had brushed shoulders with Paul over the years and always had a bad feeling they couldn't shake. One woman said Paul had a history of sexual assault. Another described an incident in Southern California where he cornered her in a dark parking lot. The stories were horrifying and eerily consistent. And suddenly, the San Luis Obispo Sheriff's Department had no choice but to pay attention. They reopened the investigation. For real this time. Not a courtesy glance. Not a hollow statement to pacify the public. A full-blown re-examination of the case. And that was when everything changed. In 2020, search warrants were executed at the homes of Paul Flores and his parents. Cadaver dogs were brought in again. Ground-penetrating radar. Forensics teams. They tore up the backyard, dug under the deck, searched the garage. And again, just like back in the dorm, cadaver dogs alerted. This time, in Paul's father's backyard, right near the edge of the property, where the soil had been disturbed, where neighbors claimed to have seen trucks pulling up late at night in the weeks after Kristen vanished. Evidence was collected. Boxes of it. Computers. Old cell phones. Surveillance footage. They even pulled a car out of storage. One the Flores family hadn't used in decades. But they still hadn't found her. Kristen's body remained lost somewhere. Hidden. Maybe moved. Maybe destroyed. And yet, despite that, something had shifted. The DA's office finally had what they needed. A pattern of predatory behavior. A web of lies. And enough circumstantial and forensic evidence to convince a jury that Kristen wasn't just missing. She had been murdered. And Paul Flores had done it. In April 2021, 25 years after Kristen Smart disappeared, Paul Flores was arrested and charged with her murder. 25. Fucking. Years. I can still hear the gasps that day. The way people exhaled like they hadn't breathed since 1996. For Kristen's family, it wasn't joy. It wasn't even relief. It was a different kind of ache, like someone had opened the wound again, only this time, the blade cut deeper. They arrested Paul's father too, Ruben Flores, charged him with accessory to murder for allegedly helping hide Kristen's body in the days after the crime. It was surreal. For years, people had whispered their names in frustration. Now, those names were written on arrest warrants, carved into indictments, echoing in courtroom chambers where the walls had finally started to listen. I kept thinking, what if Chris Lambert had never made that podcast? What if he had just kept writing music? What if he hadn't cared enough to dig? Would Paul Flores still be walking free? Would Kristen's name have faded into dust? You want to believe justice comes on its own. But the truth, sometimes justice has to be dragged, kicking, screaming, begging to be left buried. And sometimes the person who drags it isn't a cop or a judge or a lawyer. Sometimes it's just a guy with a microphone, a broken heart, and a whole lot of questions. Chapter 3. The courtroom that time built. I'd spent 25 years imagining what justice would look like. You think about it a lot when you follow a case like Kristen Smart's. You imagine the cuffs, the courtroom, the verdict, the tears. You imagine truth bursting into the room like light after a blackout, clean, sharp, blinding. But the truth is messier than that. Justice doesn't show up clean. It limps in, scarred and shaky, dragging its feet across the decades like an old man trying to remember his name. And when it does arrive, it's not triumphant. It's tired, exhausted from being ignored for so long. And in August 2022, when Paul Flores finally went to trial for Kristen Smart's murder, that courtroom wasn't a temple of clarity. It was a battlefield of ghosts. I was there the day it began. Not in the jury box. Not at the defense table. Just one of many sitting in the gallery, holding our breath. Survivors. Advocates. Strangers who had turned into believers. We'd been through the years of silence, the rejections, the podcasts, the arrests, and now finally we were here. Two separate courtrooms. Two separate trials. One for Paul Flores, charged with murder. One for his father, Ruben, charged with helping conceal Kristen's body. Same courthouse. Same building. But each courtroom holding a different part of the truth, like split sides of a broken mirror. I sat in Paul's courtroom. He walked in wearing a mask, dark suit, shoulders hunched like the weight of time had finally pressed down on him. But there was no remorse in his eyes. No regret. Just the hollow, dead stare of a man who had gotten away with something for far too long, and now wasn't sure if he'd make it through. The prosecution opened with fire. They said what we had all known in our bones for decades, that Paul Flores was a predator. That he had taken advantage of Kristen when she was intoxicated. That she had never made it past his dorm. That he raped her, killed her, hid her, and had been lying every day since. They didn't pretend to have a perfect case. There was no DNA, no smoking gun, no body. But they had something else. They had pattern. They had history. They had stories that stretched back years. Women who had remained silent for too long, who now sat in that courtroom with trembling hands and steel in their voices, ready to say his name out loud. I remember the first one. She was older now, gray at the temples, but you could still see the fear behind her eyes. She talked about a night in the early 2000s, how Paul had drugged her drink, how she woke up in his bed with no memory of how she got there, how he laughed when she asked what happened. There were others, women from different towns, different years, all of them with eerily similar stories. Passed out drinks. Foggy memories. Paul Flores lurking in the background like a fucking nightmare that never ends. And with each testimony, the prosecution's case grew stronger. Not because they had new evidence of Kristen's murder, but because they were showing the jury a predator's pattern. This is who he was, the prosecutor said. Long before Kristen. Long after. And in 1996, when she was vulnerable, when she was drunk, when she needed help, he didn't walk her home. He ended her life. I'll never forget those words. And I'll never forget what it felt like to see the Smart family sitting just a few rows ahead of me, silent, unmoving, like statues carved out of grief. Stan Smart sat tall, shoulders stiff, jaw clenched so tight you could almost hear it grind. Denise, quieter, smaller, but with eyes that could pierce through walls. They had waited 26 years to hear someone say their daughter's name in a courtroom that wasn't shrugging her off. That wasn't saying runaway or probably fine. That wasn't pretending she never mattered. Kristen Smart mattered here. Her name was said over and over again. Her photo displayed, her smile lighting up a room full of darkness. She wasn't forgotten anymore. But then came the defense. And fuck, was that hard to sit through. Paul's attorney painted him as awkward. Shy. Misunderstood. They said he was a scapegoat, an easy target in a case with no body, no blood, no direct proof. They accused the media of creating a villain, accused Chris Lambert and the podcast of poisoning the well. They said Paul had cooperated, that he was being railroaded by the court of public opinion. It made my skin crawl. Because when you've spent years looking into the abyss of this case, you don't need a body to know a crime happened. You feel it. Every day. In every headline. Every sleepless night. Every time you see the haunted faces of the people left behind. But the defense was slick. Methodical. Good at their job. And the jury? Well, juries are human. They doubt. They struggle. They question. Meanwhile, in the courtroom next door, Ruben Flores sat on trial for allegedly helping his son bury Kristen's body beneath the deck of his home in Arroyo Grande. The prosecution presented soil analysis, cadaver dog alerts, testimonies from neighbors, suspicious phone records. They argued that after Kristen's death, her body had been transported to Ruben's house and buried, possibly for years, before being moved again. But the defense poked holes. They said the dirt was inconclusive, that the dogs could have been mistaken, that the evidence was circumstantial, not hard proof. Both trials ran in tandem. Different juries. Different questions. but the same ache hanging in the air like smoke after a fire that never quite went out. The Smart family had to relive every moment. They sat through testimony after testimony, watching the clock rewind to 1996, again and again, forced to stare into the void of what they lost and what they'd never recover. There was no happy ending coming, no revelation of where the body was buried, no tearful confession, just cold facts, hard pain, and the hope that this time, the system would finally stop failing them. The closing arguments were brutal. The prosecutor stood before the jury and said, "You don't need a confession to know what happened. You don't need a body to deliver justice. You need to believe her story matters. And you need to believe that monsters don't always hide in the dark. They hide in plain sight." For 26 years, I was in tears, not just for Kristen, but for every voice that's ever been silenced. Every girl who was told she's probably just out with friends. Every parent who begged for help and got bureaucracy instead. Then came the waiting. Days of silence. Jury deliberations are quiet torture. You try to distract yourself, but your stomach stays knotted. You jump at every news alert. You pray. You curse. You hope. And finally, in October 2022, the verdict came down. Paul Flores, guilty of first-degree murder in the death of Kristen Smart. It felt surreal. After all the years, all the doubt, all the silence, a jury had finally spoken the words the world needed to hear. Paul was handcuffed and taken away. And in the next courtroom, his father, Ruben, not guilty, acquitted. And just like that, the victory came with a bitter aftertaste. One man would serve time, but another, who may have helped erase a girl from the earth, would walk free. And Kristen, still missing, still gone, still somewhere out there, under the soil or the waves or the stars. But in that moment, something shifted. Not closure. That's a myth. But acknowledgement. The world had looked away for 26 years. But now, finally, it looked back. And it said her name. Out loud. Chapter 4. The sentence that wasn't enough. When the word guilty echoed through the courtroom, there was no cheer. No applause. No triumphant fist in the air. Just silence. Heavy. Sharp. Reverent. Like the sound after a war ends, and you realize there's nothing left to rebuild with. We had waited 26 years for that word. Guilty. We imagined it would feel like victory, like justice punching a hole through the darkness. But in reality, it didn't feel like winning. It felt like surviving. I remember watching Paul Flores sit stone-faced as the jury foreperson read the verdict. Not a flinch. Not a twitch of guilt or horror or sadness. Just that same dead-eyed stare he'd worn since day one. He didn't cry. He didn't protest. He just blinked, slow reptilian. Like he'd finally accepted that the mask he'd worn all these years had cracked, and there was no point in pretending anymore. The judge ordered him to be taken into custody immediately. No bail. No delay. The bailiff cuffed him, and for the first time, I saw him as small. Not some shadow lurking in rumors or court filings. Not a monster. Just a man, aging, soft-bellied, defeated. But make no mistake, evil doesn't always come in snarling, obvious forms. Sometimes it looks like that. Dull. Ordinary. Forgettable. The crowd didn't exhale. Not really. We all sat still, waiting for something, anything, to feel right. But when you lose someone and never find them, even justice arrives incomplete. Kristen's parents. God. I don't think I'll ever forget the way they looked that day. Stan Smart sat absolutely still, like a statue carved from pain. His lips pressed so tightly together they turned white. His hands locked in fists that trembled, not from anger, but from everything else he couldn't say. Denise sat next to him, clutching a tissue in both hands, her shoulders shaking in silent sobs that tore right through me. They didn't cry because they were happy. They cried because they were fucking tired. Because 26 years is too long to carry grief on your back without buckling. And now they were being asked to carry something else. The truth. At least part of it. We all were. But truth, as it turns out, is a heavy thing. Especially when it comes this late. And it didn't help that just a few feet away, in a different courtroom, Ruben Flores, the man accused of helping his son dispose of Kristen's body, was acquitted. Not guilty. Just like that. A split decision that landed like a sucker punch. Some of us sat in stunned disbelief. Others shook their heads in disgust. Because whatever legal gymnastics got Ruben off the hook didn't change what we knew. That backyard. That disturbed soil. The neighbor's witness statement about late-night digging. The cadaver dog alerts. the garage surveillance, all of it was real. And still he walked. But the law isn't built on what you know. It's built on what you can prove. And in that courtroom, it wasn't enough. So Ruben went home. Paul went to prison. And Kristen was still missing. That's what haunted us in the days after the trial. The fact that after everything, after all the testimonies and evidence and tears, we still didn't know where she was. No grave to visit. No plot to lay flowers on. No headstone to rest your hand against and whisper, "I miss you," into the wind. Just absence. Absence that filled every room her family entered. Absence that echoed in the spaces between every news headline. Absence that left a gaping, open wound in the soul of San Luis Obispo and across the world. I think that's why sentencing day felt so strange. It came in March 2023, nearly a year after Paul Flores had been arrested. The courtroom filled again. Reporters lined the walls. Supporters wore buttons with Kristen's face. Some of us came from out of town. Long drives, booked hotels, handwritten notes we'd never deliver, but needed to write anyway. Paul wore prison orange. He looked thinner, more sunken, but still expressionless. Like everything inside him had calcified. Or maybe it had never been there to begin with. The judge read the sentence. 25 years to life. No possibility of parole for the first 2 decades. It was technically the maximum allowed under the law for his charge. And yet, it didn't feel like enough. How could it? How do you balance the scales between a lifetime and a life stolen? Kristen would have been 45. She might have had a career in architecture, or environmental science, or whatever dream she had scribbled in the margins of her freshman notebooks. She might have traveled the world, fallen in love, built a home. She might have written books, taught classes, raised children. Instead, her life stopped at 19. Erased, hidden, discarded like trash. And the man who did it, he got to live for 26 years without consequence. He got jobs, went to bars, took vacations, spent Christmas with his family, all while the smart family lit candles on anniversaries and sat beside an empty chair at dinner. So no, 25 to life didn't feel like enough. But it was something, a start. And sometimes, in the shadow of failure, something is more than we hoped for. After sentencing, the smart family finally spoke. Stan stepped up to the podium, his voice steady but raw. He thanked the detectives, the DA, the community. But more than anything, he spoke to Kristen. "My daughter," he said, "you were never forgotten. Not for 1 second. And even now, though we still don't know where you are, we know you've been with us. Every step. And we will keep looking. Until we bring you home." I felt the entire courtroom hold its breath. Denise followed, quieter, her voice breaking halfway through. "We were told to give up. We were told to let go. We never did. And we never will. Kristen deserves peace. She deserves to be found. And they're right. Because even with the conviction, the truth is, we still have no body. No closure. No place to mourn. The search continues. The sheriff's department has said publicly they believe Kristen's remains were moved, possibly more than once. They're still combing property records, surveillance, old tips. Cadaver dogs are being used again. Volunteers are still searching hillsides and ravines. But the terrain is vast. And time has a way of burying more than just bones. Still, people haven't given up. Your own backyard continues to release updates. Chris Lambert has remained in contact with the family. Advocates are organizing annual events. Billboards go up every May. Kristen's Law, a missing persons policy inspired in part by her case, has already saved lives. Her story has become more than just tragedy. It's become legacy. But let me be honest about something that no one likes to say out loud. Justice, even when it finally arrives, doesn't heal everything. There's no rewind button. No erasing the years lost. No undoing the trauma. Justice just sits beside you now. Quietly. Like a tired friend who showed up late, holding your hand but not knowing what to say. And maybe that's enough. Maybe that's what we get. A courtroom. A sentence. A scar we carry forward so we don't forget. Because forgetting? That's the real crime. Chapter 5, The Echo That Won't Die. You'd think that after a guilty verdict and a prison sentence, the story would be over. That the doors would close. That the pain would end. But in real life, true crime doesn't wrap itself in a neat little bow. There's no end credits. No soft fade to black. There's only after. And after is where we live now. Kristen Smart is still missing. Her remains have never been recovered. Her parents still sleep with the porch light on. still wait for a call that might never come, still chase answers through shadows and dust and fields of silence. 26 years of grief didn't disappear the moment a gavel slammed down. It just changed shape. But something did happen in the wake of all this. Something important. Something worth remembering. People started paying attention. Not just to Kristen, but to all the others. The girls who go missing and get written off. The families who get gaslit by systems too lazy to care. The cases buried by time, bureaucracy, and indifference. People started to ask questions they never asked before. And it all started with a voice. Your own backyard lit the fuse. Chris Lambert wasn't a cop, wasn't a journalist. He didn't have a badge or a press pass. What he had was a sense of moral responsibility, a microphone, a willingness to listen when everyone else had gone quiet. And that was enough. It reminded me of something I once read. The most dangerous thing you can do to the truth is ignore it. Because the longer you ignore it, the louder it screams. That podcast screamed. It brought Kristen's story back into the light. It reignited the investigation. It reached people who mattered, people in law enforcement, in government, in journalism. It reminded us all what happens when we stay silent. Evil gets comfortable. Predators feel invincible. And girls like Kristen disappear into the cracks. Chris didn't do it alone. He had researchers, sources, listeners who came forward. But he started it. And that's a legacy no one can take away. It's strange how one life can become a compass for so many others. Kristen Smart became that compass. Her story reached beyond San Luis Obispo, beyond California. It became a case study in how not to handle a missing person investigation, and then later, in how relentless love and modern tools like podcasts, social media, and digital advocacy could flip the script. Colleges updated their campus safety policies. Police departments quietly reviewed their cold case protocols. Victims' families started hiring independent investigators sooner. People learned from the wreckage of this case. They built new blueprints from it. Not because the system suddenly fixed itself, but because the community made enough noise that the system had no choice but to listen. That noise, it came from people like you. People who didn't know Kristen, but couldn't forget her. Listeners who downloaded the podcast. Readers who shared her story. Strangers who wore buttons with her face. Who lit candles. Who wrote letters to lawmakers. Who donated to the Smart Families Legal Fund. Who joined Facebook groups. Who kept asking, where is she? It mattered. Because every time her name was spoken, it took oxygen away from the silence that protected her killer for so long. And now here we are. Paul Flores is behind bars. Ruben Flores walks free, but with the stain of suspicion forever tied to his name. And Kristen, she's still out there. Somewhere. I've driven the coastlines. Hiked the trails near Arroyo Grande. Looked out over the fields that stretch for miles, trying to imagine where she might be. Under trees? Beneath concrete? In some forgotten ravine where no one thought to look? We don't know. And the weight of that unknowing is something the Smart family carries every single day. Denise once said in an interview, I just want her to be brought home. I want to lay her to rest. I want to give her peace. I want her name spoken without pain. She deserves that. Kristen deserves a grave. A headstone. A place where people can stand and remember that she lived. That she mattered. That she wasn't just the girl who vanished. Because she was more than a victim. She was a dreamer, a thinker, a sister, a daughter, a friend. She had a quirky laugh, a sharp mind, and a notebook full of plans for the future. And even in death, or the space where death and absence collide, she still changed the world. Let that settle for a moment. A young woman who never got to finish her freshman year still sparked national reform, still forced law enforcement to evolve, still brought justice, even without being found. Her life wasn't defined by the night it was stolen. It was defined by what came after. And what came after was all of us. We became the voice she couldn't use. We told her story when the media moved on. We stood behind her parents when the world told them to let go. We refused to forget. And that refusal? That is how justice is born. Not in a flash of glory, but in grit, in persistence, in the sacred, stubborn act of not giving up. So where do we go from here? We keep speaking her name. We keep asking questions. We keep believing survivors. We hold systems accountable. We keep the pressure on. Because justice, real justice, isn't about locking someone up. It's about telling the truth. Loudly. Repeatedly. Fearlessly. It's about making sure that the next Kristen Smart never falls through the cracks. That the next family doesn't have to wait 26 years for answers. That the next missing girl doesn't become a footnote in a dusty file. And maybe, just maybe, someday soon, someone will stumble on a clue. A breakthrough. A moment that cracks the silence wide open. Maybe Kristen will finally come home. And when she does, she'll be met with love. With light. With 1,000 whispered voices saying, "We never stopped looking." Because the echo of her story won't die. It can't. Not as long as we keep listening. Not as long as we remember.